And it's a description of all of the various trade patterns that the city, these places that the city is involved in. It's eventually part of a critique against the city that, despite all of their fame and accumulated wealth, none of this will help them. They are still going to be destroyed. That's the end message that you're going to get to. But it has a very interesting arrangement of and description of the trade of Tyre. And this is very difficult and interesting biblical text. So today we're going to sort of read through this and try and get a better understanding of the trade of Tyre and what's sort of going on and how this fits within the larger context and framework of the biblical world. So we are mostly going to sit around and we are going to read through Ezekiel 27 and look at some of the questions, because it really is a very difficult text. Yes?
So, do you think that all those prophecies and cursing or whatever, is it all directed to the king of Tyre? In Arabic we say Sur.
Yes, Sur. Yes.
Saiba and Sur. Sur and Saiba. Sidon and Sur.
Sur, yes.
So the whole thing is addressed to the king of Tyre?
It not necessarily addressed to him, but certainly regarding the city of Tyre, but not just its king, but the king included.
You know, I'm asking based on a verse, 28, Ezekiel 28. To whom this thing addressed to, if you can read it? Ezekiel 28.
Yeah, 28 verse 2.
To whom this statement addressed?
Le Nagid Tsur. Le Nagid Tsur.
To?
Nagid Tsur.
English says to the ruler of Tyre.
Prince of Tyre.
Yeah, madam, for the issue. When he says in verse 2, son of Adam, say to the chief of Tyre, this is what the Lord said, for because you raise up your heart, and continue on verse 2:28, is it addressed to the king of Tyre himself or someone else? And who is that?
Or the whole of Tyre, is that what we're asking?
Are we delaying you from...
Slightly,
yeah.
But, you know.
The ruler affects everybody.
We have questions at the end, yeah.
I don't want to get into Ezekiel 28:3 because that's also a very difficult passage at the moment.
That, very easy.
What? Three? Yeah.
It's very easy. It applies only to one personality.
Okay, but we're going to go back to Ezekiel 27:12, so before this, because I am concerned with trade, because I study ancient economics, so this passage is interesting to me. So would somebody like to read Ezekiel 27:12 for us?
Tarshish did business with you because of your great wealth of goods. They exchanged silver, iron, tin, and lead for your merchandise.
Okay, and that's a very standard translation for how you're going to understand this. So, and this is a pattern that you're going to see throughout this. It's you're going to have a location, and they're working as your traders or merchants. And then they are dealing in or trading in various wares. So for this one we have Farshish is your dealer, and they're going in what? Silver, iron, lead, and tin, I believe.
Yeah.
Silver, iron, tin, but yeah.
Yeah. So the The translation of this is difficult. You start out with Tarshish Sohatech, which is Tarshish it was your, and then here it's a feminine participle for the trade. So some sort of trader or dealer, some kind of again, business person. I usually translate sohatech as your dealer, and then there's another term we'll talk later that I usually do merchants. So they are your dealer because of all your wealth. This is why they want to trade with you, and they're dealing in silver, iron, lead, and tin, which they're selling to you for your. Again, it translates often for your merchandise, and it seems more likely to be for the purpose of your export. There's the term at the end is uzbonim, which is something to do with azab, which is like to go out or to leave, would be the verb. So the word they translate as merchandise is the thing that's leaving from somewhere, and it has to do some kind of export. So what you basically have is that the Tarshish is your dealer in these various things that you are exporting. So what a lot of what Tyre does is they buy goods from one place, and they sell them at another place, and they profit off the differential exchange rate. They're operating on the fact that you can buy certain things cheaper in one area than the other, and they're highly connected. So this izbonim or izbonai at the end of the verse that's translated merchandise is really like for your re-export, for your redistribution to take advantage of this differential exchange rate. So the first place that's mentioned is Tarshish. Where is Tarshish?
Spain.
Okay.
Spanish Iberian Peninsula.
Yes, most likely the Iberian Peninsula. People associated with Tartessus. Tartessus is listed as a source of silver, lead, tin, and iron in Strabo or Diodorus. Some of these classical sources list some of these same goods. But we also know from archaeology that the Iberian Peninsula is very wealthy in metals. The Phoenicians colonized the Iberian Peninsula starting late 8th century, early 7th century BCE. You start seeing Phoenician settlements in the southern Spain. A lot of these are associated with metallurgy sites. You have sites at Huelva and Rio Tinto, Sismonte Romero, where they're doing silver mining. Silver mining is very big in ancient Spain. Tin is very uncommon naturally in the sort of ancient Near East. Most of it's imported from Afghanistan, but starting in the late Iron Age, there are tin mines in northern Portugal. So sort of up again, not quite right on the coast there, but the Phoenicians have colonies up in the hills by these tin mines and are likely, again, shipping them down to your port at Tarshish would be a good place to get it. Iron occurs frequently throughout the Pyrite Belt. That's sort of, if you have the Iberian coast, then you have the coastal plain, then you have some slight hilllands into the Pyrite Belt, which is where all these metals are. Also very rich in iron. Lead, they have some there. It's usually a cast-off. They may also be importing it. We know they're using it. If we look at Phoenician metallurgy sites, they all have lead slag, this cast-off from the production process. So we know they're using extensive amounts of lead, but it doesn't occur in high values naturally. During the Roman period, they're importing all their lead from North Africa. And it may be that it's the same, it's also the case in the Iron Age. So we do have, this first place, Tarshish, all of these materials that are coming in fit very well with established Phoenician trade patterns that we know from archaeology, that we know from other places. The goods make perfect sense and fit in with this Phoenician settlement pattern. All right, next verse, because I want to read me, place number 15.
27, 13. Greece, Tubal, and Meshech traded with you, They exchanged slaves and articles of bronze for your wares. Not your wives, your wares. Let's misread that. What's Tuval? What's Tuval?
We'll get there.
You're going to get there? I thought you were probably going to get there. Pretty soon, no. Tagorstor. I think I know where it is.
Alright, so the Hebrew, it's Yavan Tuval Vameshek. So Yavan is Greece, is how we're going to translate it. Technically, probably more specifically Ionia, but it's sort of a collective term that can refer to numerous Ionian Greeks. The Bible doesn't really differentiate very much between the various Greek peoples, which is true of most ancient Near Eastern texts.
Now it's like Hellenic or something, Hellenic Union or something. Hellenic.
Something like that. The Ionians are certainly the ones that the ancient Near Eastern people are, like people in Israel and Assyria are interacting with the most frequently. Ionians are mentioned in the text of Tiglath-Pileser III. They raid around the various places, so it may be that these are just the people from Greece that they have the most contact with are the Ionians, and they use it as a collective to refer to the entire area. But Yavan is certainly Greece, or this sort of Ionian Aegean. Tuval is likely the province of Tabal. It's an Aramean state in sort of north Syria,
getting into Anatolia. I don't have it on my map.
Is it like Kurdistan area or something up in there?
More like eastern Turkey.
Eastern Turkey.
Yeah. Eastern Turkey.
Ararat's eastern Turkey.
Yeah, that general type of area. It's one of these Neo-Hittite Aramean states. It's mentioned frequently in the New Assyrian records dealing with this area. It's a kingdom, and one of these Aramean kingdoms that replaces this Hittite world. It's a western neighbor to like Aram Damascus, which we've all heard of. So it's one of these states, probably in this area of Tava. Then Meshek is probably again one of these Anatolian Aramean city states. Mushku, mentioned in the textual records from Assyria, and this is where we consider Phrygia would be this general area. So again, Anatolia. So these are areas of Anatolia.
Maybe you know this, but I knew Isaiah 66 has all of these listed in it also.
Yeah.
Tuval, Greece, Lydians, and all. Yeah, that's the one I knew.
Yeah. And so that again is also talking about this this connection from the Greek world through Asia Minor down to Cilicia. Those are all sort of connected in biblical geographic terms. You'll also notice that a lot of these occur in Genesis 10 in the Table of Nations. A lot of these are things that you know from the Table of Nations. And also the Isaiah passage that you mentioned also is dealing some with the Table of Nations. So we'll see a lot of repetition of these locations within that larger
just
context.
To represent the verse, it says the nations and to the distant nations who have not heard of my fame or seen my glory. At that point in the Isaiah prophecy,
and these are all distant places for Israel. Right. These are places that Tyre, who trades with everyone, trades with, but that Israel does not have extensive contact with. Can I just
my pen? Can you
just pick up this letter?
Yep.
Sweet. And so they're said to be dealing with human beings and vessels of bronze. This Nefesh Adam, human beings. This is almost certainly slaves. That's how the Septuagint translates it, and it's dealing with slaves. The Phoenicians are well known for their involvement in the slave trade. They are characterized specifically as slavers in the Homeric epics, in the Iliad and the Odyssey. They go around kidnapping people and trying to sell them into slavery. But the biblical text also mentions them as involved in the slave trade. You have, for example, Amos. If you go into Amos 1, for three sins of Tyre and four, I will not revoke their punishment for giving up whole people of Edom, again, trading them into slavery. You also would have Joel 2:4. You sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks, removing them far from their own borders. And so this is again showing the Greeks and Phoenicians are involved in some kind of slave trade.
Sorry, I'm not sure. I got Tubal on my laptop. It says Kibbutz in northern Israel now also. On the Lebanon border, Kibbutz called Tubal.
That's okay. So this idea of the Phoenicians and Greeks as slave traders is very common in the ancient world, and it makes a lot of sense. Because what are they able to do? Is take one person and move them far, far away. Because you can't sell someone into slavery next door. You have to get them far away so there's no way they can get back. So who are involved in the slave trade? Merchants, shipping. And this is more modern idea in America of Shanghaiing, right? That you go down to the docks, you grab somebody, you throw them on the ship, and now they're stuck there and they're working on your ship because there's nothing else to do. It's that type of idea that once you get someone on a boat and are going far away, there's nothing they can do about it, which makes these sea traders very effective slave traders as well. You also see this with the caravans. A caravan is going long ways through the desert. Once you're with them, you're not running away. And once you end up somewhere else, you're a long way from home. You see this in the Joseph narrative. Joseph gets sold to what? A Midianite caravan coming, coming through the region. So you have this idea that traders are also often slavers because they can get you very far away from where you're from and any support system, and there's no real way for you to run away on the way there and get yourself home because you're in the middle of the desert or the ocean.
You escape.
Sometimes, yeah, it happens.
So
slaves are some of the things. And then bronze vessels. Again, these worked copper things are very common in the region of Anatolia. The Assyrians mention them in almost all their lists of tribute taken, all the things you pay to them. You always have these bronze cauldrons or these bronze basins that they're sending. So we have archaeological evidence of some of these. So they're a fairly common artifact that you might expect from places such as Tubal or Tabal and Mushku. All right. Next one, 27:14. Can someone read it?
I got it. From Bet Togarma, they bartered horses, horsemen, and mules for your wares.
So Beit Togarma is, anyone know where this one is?
I'm guessing it's something Aramean since it starts with a B.
Essentially. Again, we know that the Beit starting before something, we have the Assyrians of Beit David. For example, House of David would be another word for the Kingdom of Judah. Beit Homri in the Assyrian context is the House of Omri. That's their term for the Kingdom of Israel, the Northern Kingdom. So people have suggested that this is Beit Tugdame, reading the race as a Dalit, possible. Tugdame is a king of the Sumerians. The Sumerians are a group of people that are living up in Anatolia, somewhere around here, and it makes sense. That's a possible reading. Other people have associated this with this Assyrian city of Tilgarimu, which is again somewhere in sort of eastern Anatolia. So there's some question on where exactly Beit Togarma is, but they're both kind of in that Aramean Anatolian type world. Maybe as far north as sort of southern Armenia, but it's there's not too much of a difference. And again, their goods are listed as horses. I think you read horsemen in your translation, and mules. Wild horses are present throughout Anatolia. Wild horses are native to sort of the steppe region, even further north into Central Asia. But there are some native to Anatolia. Anatolia is very well known for high quality horses. because they naturally breed in the wild there, and they have some fairly good and relatively pure stocks. So horses from this area are very commonly drafted in the Assyrian texts. They'll draft a lot of horses from here. The other term is parashim. So you have susim and parashim. And parashim is generally a term referred to as horsemen, as your translation translated, although you're not dealing in horsemen. So you're not shipping a bunch of horsemen around with all of these goods. So there's some, and susim and parashim, they occur together in sort of Hindites in various contexts that seem to be different types of horses. But the idea is that there's a type of horse that you can ride, and there's a type of horse that you would use for pulling chariots and as draft horses only. And that the parashim, even though it's horseman, is really the latter, that it's a draft horse, a chariot horse, or a horseman, and then your susim is sort of your riding horse. But anyway, the idea would be that there are two different types of horses. Someone suggested that this is even the difference between a stallion or a gelding, depending on how, you know, how easy they are to ride, although that's certainly not clear. But the idea is that you have different types of horses for different types of use, and mules, which are your common ones, all of which we would absolutely expect from the Anatolian world. Okay, next verse.
The Danites were your clients, many coastlands were your customers, they paid you with ivory tusks and ebony.
Alright, so they you translate as the Danites. Anyone have a different translation for that?
Men of Rhodes.
Men of Rhodes. How are we getting that difference? The Hebrew has it as Bene Dedan, so the sons of Dedan. So Bene Dedan. And so you have, all you have to do is if you change the Dalet to a Resh, Dalet looks fairly similar to Resh. So Bene Dedan, you have Bene Redan, which would be Rhodians. So by just reading the Dalet as a Resh, which most translations do nowadays, you end up with the idea of Rhodians rather than these Dedanites.
That's the island of Rhodos?
Yeah.
That's Rhodos, yeah.
One of the reasons that they like changing this is Dedan occurs later in the same passage in verse 20. You have Dedan as mentioned again, so it would be odd for it to be mentioned twice. And Rhodes makes a little bit more sense geographically. If we're moving in sort of this west to east and north to south, or northwest to southeast type trajectory, Rhodes fits that geographical pattern better, which is certainly, and if you're looking back at passages like the Table of Nations, it's going to fit in better with those types of patterning. Your problem is, what are the goods I'm listing? Ivory and ebony. Where are ivory and ebony from?
India and Africa.
India and Africa. Mostly, in this case, probably Africa, probably Egypt. Ivory, again, you're either getting it from elephant tusk or hippopotamus tooth. Hippopotamus tooth is very common for ivory in the late Bronze Age, but hippopotami are extinct in the region, so there's no more hippopotamus tooth ivory by the time you're getting into the 6th century, the time of Ezekiel. Your other option is elephant tusks. Your elephants are either coming from Africa or India, although there has been this, the concept of the Syrian elephant. The Assyrian texts mention elephant hunting up in north Syria. And there's apparently a very small population there, but they the latest texts that mention it are Tiglath-Pileser III, which is about 8th century BCE. You have mentions to the North Syrian one. So there are clearly a few wild ones, but there's clearly not very many of them. Irene Winter has suggested that they're a migratory herd that actually got brought up from India. Cologne thinks they go extinct up there around the 10th or 11th century. But there is this possibility of the Syrian elephant as a derivative of the Indian elephant in North Syria, but it seems like certainly by the 6th century they're extinct and not being exploited. And plus, ebony is not coming from anywhere there. Ebony comes from, depending on the type, you can get it in areas of Sudan, You can also get it then getting into India, Ceylon, and some of these types of areas. This ebony mentioned in this passage is certainly coming from Egypt. The Hebrew for it, Hovanim, is a loan word from Egyptian, the Egyptian word for ebony. So they're clearly associating with this. Problem is, all of these goods are associated with Rhodes. And so how is Rhodes getting the Egyptian goods? Well, Rhodes is probably trading with Egypt, and it's this idea of they may be the middlemen that are bringing it back to Phoenicia. It's also interesting that Egypt is not mentioned in this list of trade partners, which is odd because we know that Tyre is trading with Egypt. It's mentioned earlier in the chapter. I don't want to get into that too much right now. But the Rhodians are these people, these middlemen bringing through these goods of Egypt. So it's a bit problematic, but again, it's what we have. Next verse. Can someone read it?
Aram did business with you because of your many products. They exchanged turquoise, purple fabric, embroidered work, fine linen, coral, and rubies for your merchandise.
All right, now we're going to start having some fun. So does anyone have a different translation of the beginning of that verse? This one? All right, so I don't know how the various ones do it. So you have Aram was your customer or your dealer, although most people, so you have Aram, and most people are going to actually end up reading that as Edom, as Edom, instead. And again, it's a Resh Dalet switch as the primary one. And the reason behind that is because later on you have Damascus is mentioned as one of the trade partners, and Aram is a duplicate of Damascus. And looking at the goods here, people say it's better associated with Edom. They're not really well associated with anything, as we'll discuss in a minute, but a lot of people don't want, again, Aram and then Damascus, because they're the same place. So Amenthes.
Mine says
Syria. Says Edom?
Syria.
Syria. Okay, that's their translation of Aram, so.
I think.
Yeah. But they're going to translate it Syria very specifically to say a part of the Aramaean world that's separate from Aram Damascus, is what your translation's trying to do with that. But a more common emendation is Edom, and again, it's just a switch between the Resh and the Dalet, if you're going to write it without the mater, even though it usually is.
I have a question on that duplication thing. If you have the previous verse, B'nai Dadan, and then later on also B'nai Dadan, there's repetition anyway, so why would it be a problem if you have Aram and then later Damascus?
Again, it's if you assume, if you're going to read, then Dadan in two places, but it's also that the goods don't necessarily match up with what we know from these various places. So it's trying to make things work geographically and according to what we know about ancient economic patterns. You also have the problem that if there are basic geographical patterns that you can get to work with some emendations. So your movement from Tarshish to Greece to Rhodes to is sort of this west to east movement across the Mediterranean. And then if you're going to go from Edom to Judah to Damascus, that's going to be a south to north run. So you can get some geographic patternings in with a few other readings rather than having this random places all over. Because if you're reading Dagon, we'll discuss this in the first point, but where's Dagon? Way down here in Arabia. So you'd be jumping all over the place. And the question is if you think that the text has a geographical logic to it, which most scholars seem to think that it does, and I would support that. I don't think that they're just randomly throwing out places. I think there is some sort of organization to it. And again, a lot of these, you have to remember that these are not places that these are not common places that the Bible mentions too frequently. These are not places that someone's going to be highly familiar with. So the chances that Ezekiel as a writer is not necessarily very familiar with all of these places. They're the places that Tyre trades with, not the places that he's going and visiting. So the fact that there might be some confusion on some of this would also be very logical in the context.
Well, Russian dollar confusion anyways.
Yeah, it happens all the time. So I'm not yet. I'll get there. But at the moment, I'm not yet suggesting some fairly major emendations. It's letters that look very similar, racial even in modern Hebrew, but in the ancient script, and they're not changing drastically any meaning. They're just making the text a little easier. So their goods are mentioned as turquoise translated. It's nofek. It's some kind of gemstone. We know very little about it. It occurs here, another list of jewels in Ezekiel 28, and then it's part of one of the jewels of the ephod that's listed in Exodus. It's some kind of greenish blue stone, so turquoise sometimes translated as emeralds, unlikely. It's also been understood as like a garnet stone, a sort of reddish green garnet stone, which is probably more likely because you could find it locally. So about the garnets. Purple, this argamam, is some kind of purple dye. Now, there are two types of purple dye. There's argamam and tekleket. One is a red purple, mentioned here. The other is a blue purple. And these are you get them from crushing up shellfish. You crush up these shellfish, these murex shells. And these murex shells are found very commonly in Phoenicia itself, around Tyre, but also there's some at Ashdod, there's some in the south, but it's some kind of purple dye. It's interesting that the Phoenicians, that Tyre's listed as trading for purple dye, because Tyre is the major producer of purple dye. Tyre is associated in the ancient world with purple. This is what they do, your royal Tyrian purple.
We mentioned this a few weeks ago, from Lydia, when we talk about Philippi, so Lydia, the purple dye. And we wondered, I've seen it on the coast up there. I've seen the shells come in.
We have the shells down in Ashkelon. Right. They have a processing station that they found in the 7th century from Ashdod. There's a ton of them up at Sarepta. But there's these two different colors you can get, which has to do with how the chemicals work when exposed to heat and light. You can get a reddish purple or a bluish purple, or if you don't expose, you get these sort of royal purples. But anyway, the purple is associated with the coast, and particularly with Phoenicia, which doesn't make sense with either Aram or Edom, and it doesn't make sense why the Phoenicians would necessarily import it, but again, we have this some kind of purple dyed textiles that is listed in this.
Can I ask a question about the Nofek?
Yeah.
Is that for sure then a stone as opposed to color of, because I just know those other things are made from materials.
Right, so it's been suggested that it's a color, but that's the other things are not just materials. Once you get to, unless you're going to also say Ramoth and Kadkod are just colors at the end of the verse. It seems the other contexts are a list of gemstones, specifically in Ezekiel 28, and then it's one of the stones that goes into the ephod.
Right.
So in those places, it's very clearly a gemstone, and those are your only other occurrences. So,
and did you say where that particular stone is mined?
If it's a garnet, they're fairly common in Egypt. But they can come from a lot of places. There are a lot of places where you can get garnet schist coming out. I don't have a full map of it yet. If it's emeralds or turquoise, it's coming from the Red Sea region. It's coming down from...
Which would make sense with Edom.
Yes. But even from Egypt, it can make sense with Edom, too, because as we'll get to in a second. Rikma, again, you may have it as embroidery, woven cloth, something like that. Again, it's coming out of this verb, rakam, which has something to do with, again, wove together. It's some kind of embroidered cloth. Others have suggested just these different types of various cloths. It's not an incredibly common an incredibly common term, and it's some sort of technical textile term. Textiles, and again, are coming from lots of different places, and they don't show up well in the archaeological record, but there are certainly differences that you would want. You can even see in the Assyrian reliefs, everyone has their own style of clothing and their style of textiles. So we do know that you do have this issue of style and taste and fashion that has to deal with what types of clothes you're getting. This may even have to do with the purple. We make purple dye, but we want your style clothes in the purple, so they import the purple, we dye our stuff purple, and then we send it back colored. So yet none of this takes into account any idea of fashion, because you can't really comment on ancient fashion, but we know it exists. So you do have this idea of things moving around, and even the idea of, I would buy something that I can make locally because it's far away and because it's different. You get this when you go into any wine shop, and you can get wine from, if I'm in America, I can get it from France, Italy, America, Argentina, Chile, and you know, I can get any of these. It's not just because we produce it in America that we're not going to also import it, and what I buy is going to depend on a whole lot of different factors. Then you have the linen, boots, is a term here for linen. So there are two terms for linen that are used in the Bible, boots and sheish. And boots seems to be a late biblical Hebrew term, which isn't a problem. This is Ezekiel. Ezekiel's late. Ezekiel, again, 6th century historical context. We're already in the period of late biblical Hebrew. It's interesting because sheish is actually used earlier in the same chapter instead of boots. There's a mention of linen, I think in verse 10 or 11. And their sheish is actually used instead of boots. But they're both, they seem to be replaceable, interchangeable. One, the sheish comes from Egyptian. It's an Egyptian loanword. And the boots seems to come from Aramaic. From Aramaic and is a bit later. If again, Ezekiel's writing up in the north and about Phoenicia, the use of the Aramaic influenced Hebrew word would make some sense. But again, he uses sheish earlier. Linen made from flax. Flax most commonly grown in Egypt. And then coral and rubies are the last two, as according to translation. These are both difficult terms because they are not common in the biblical text. Both of them occur in only two, this and one other occurrence. Kavod, some kind of red, they both say it was some sort of reddish stone. People have done rubies, although rubies is anachronistic. There's not really a good source of rubies in the late period. Maybe some sort of agate, or a chalcedony, which again you're getting from down in Egypt. Your Ramot has been translated as coral based on an Arabic cognate that means something to do with shell, but it's not a particularly good one. And then again, this is sort of your later rabbinic interpretation, is that this is what it is, but it's not entirely clear. It's also been just something red and been interpreted as red jasper, but again, it occurs so infrequently, there's not good cognates. It could be a lot of things. I prefer to see them as gemstones, and then you have this list of stones and textiles. Precious stones are associated generally with the area of Egypt and South Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. So if Edom is sort of your gateway of the South Arabian trade that's coming up and is going to come through Edom, you would expect Edom to have access to these gemstones and then maybe some of these Egyptian-inspired textiles. If Edom is doing trade through South Arabia and through Egypt, they could potentially get their hands on all of these. Now, the traders are going all the way up to Aram, so if you wanted to read this as Aram, Aram could have access to South Arabian trade as well. They're a little bit further removed. All of these goods are goods that would be passing through as part of another trade. They're not local production of either of these places. So again, you have this idea of middleman down the line, what we call down the line trade, where this is, according to Ezekiel, this is where Tyre's getting it from, not where it's made. Ezekiel's concerned with where Tyre is getting this from, and there's a lot of middleman work going on. Okay, next verse.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Aram is not Iraq?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Aram, Damascus, includes parts of Syria and into little bits of what Iraq would be, but no. Iraq at this point is Assyria.
Aram is Iran and Aram
is mostly Syria, modern day Syria. So we'll go to read verse 17.
Judah and Israel traded with you. They exchanged wheat from the Nip and confections, honey, olive oil, and balm for your wares.
Yeah, Israel, and we have wheat, honey, oil, balm. Okay, so Judah and Israel, we all know. We got those locations down, and they're good. So we have wheat of minute, cakes or meal, depending on probably on your translation, honey, oil, and balm. So if you look at this list, you're going to see a lot of similarities with, for example, the products of the land in Deuteronomy 8:8. You know, it's all the various things that the land gives you. So you have some parallels here with Deuteronomy. You have this wheat of minute. What's minute? No one really knows. It's associated with this idea of Ma'anit, which is a location. It's a geographical location in modern-day Jordan, ancient Ammon. And the idea with that would be it's this wheat of this Ammonite bread nation across Jordan. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense because of it's the land of Israel, not the land of Ammon. Israel doesn't even exist politically at this time because this is after 722. The northern kingdom has been exiled. They turned into Assyrian provinces. Assyria's fallen already, and now it's some sort of Babylonian no man's land. And so it's called the land of Israel. It doesn't say, you know, it's Eretz Israel. So the land of the former northern kingdom, that certainly doesn't include Ammon. So if you're going to go there. Daganoff has suggested an emendation to this, which is possible, but, you know, we're getting a little bit harder here. But we have the Hebrew here is minit, so wheat of minit. And so he reads Bo-hei-teen, right? He takes that mem from here, tacks it onto the end, so he has wheat. And then he's left with nun yod-het, and he amends the nun to a zion, so zayat, so olives. So he amends it to read wheat and olives. He doesn't have an end, he's missing a vav here. But so he's trying to get this to say, instead of this random location in Ammon, or word we don't know, that it's a list of wheat, olives, cakes, honey, oil. Olives make sense according to, again, Deuteronomy 8 and those things. It's a well-known product of the land. Whether that's sort of a bit of a duplicate of oil is not clear. But that's been suggested as an emendation.
If you got amended quite extensively, that
yes.
Also, could you just say the meat, wherever it's from,
as a geographic location?
It could be the seed that was typical to that place that is now bred and brought to other places.
Well, it's not going to be bred.
Or
because you're not going to ship bread because it's going to be
breed bread. Like hybrid.
Yeah.
Or like, let's say you blend that type of wheat, so you take the wheat from that area and plant it.
Yeah, and we'll find this later with the wine of Helbon, right? That you do get these geographical descriptors on a certain type of thing. So you could have wheat being a specific type of wheat. And we do know that there's favors for different types of grains, of various types of cereals, especially when you get into the Greco-Roman world, depending whether you want to make whole wheat or this type of mixes, that there are certain types of cereals that are preferable to certain types of things. We also know that Judah is traditionally supplied wheat to Tyre. If you look back to when Solomon's building the temple, and he says, "Send me all of your cedars," down in what, 1 Kings 5, I think. And then part of the agreement is, "And I'm going to yearly supply you with food, ship you up bunches and bunches of wheat." Tyre has a consistent food supply problem. They have a very large population. They don't have a lot of agricultural land. And so getting large amounts of food from the breadbaskets of places like Israel is important to their ability to feed their population. So we know that wheat's coming coming through. And again, you know, that invasion is not too important. It's just, it's been suggested.
Mixing those materials come up with our pancake today. Honey and olive oil.
And preferably not balm, though.
Yeah.
We'll get to it in a minute. Well, your
pancakes.
Speaking of pancakes, the word for cakes that's often translated as cakes in the verse is panag, is the Hebrew word. And this is often translated as sort of either a meal or some kind of a cake based off of it's a hapax. This is the only occurrence of it in the Hebrew Bible. It's based off of a Babylonian word, pelanigu, or palanigu. So,
which is what?
A type of meal or a type of cake. However, back in the late 70s, Stoll has argued that perhaps panag is related to the Greek panakes, which is a kind of apopanas, which is a gum resin. It's a type of a resin that you would find in there. So this would go well with the balm if you were going to, because you have this honey, oil, and balm. Your balm is again this type of sari, is your type of terebinth resin. So it's coming from your trees, and it's some type of aromatic and sealant. So if you're going to have other resins, it could possibly be a papanax as well. You have two resins listed here. Again, the word only occurs one time, and it's fairly difficult. Again, honey and oil are fairly straightforward. Those are well attested as products of Israel. Again, if it's cakes, you prefer meal to cakes, because if you've ever tried to ship a cake on a boat long distance, by the time the cake gets there, you don't want the cake anymore. If you're dealing with long distance trade from Judah up to Tyre is a long way, so you're not going to want any kind of bread or cake. You're going to want some kind of meal or millet or something like that kind, or possibly again this type of aromatic or resin. Next verse. Someone read it, please.
Damascus sent merchants to buy your rich variety of goods, bringing wine from Helbon and white wool from Zahar.
All right, so now we have Damascus showing up again. Again, the location on this is very clear. The city, but also the nation-state, the Syrian state of Aram Damascus. And they're mentioned specifically with wine of Helbon and white wool. Is that what the translation said? Great. So you have this mention of your wine of Helbon. Note that wine is not mentioned with Judah and Israel, even though we know they're growing wine here. They are not importing wine from Judah and Israel. They're importing wine from Helbon. Why are they importing wine from Helbon? Because wine from Helbon is very, very good wine. We have lists of various sacrificial wines and royal wines taken, for example, by Nebuchadnezzar II and offered to Marduk. And listed in these are things like wine of Helbon. So we know that it is a known brand. It would be...
Is it a city? What is Helbon?
Yeah, it's a city. Or a vague region. It's also a city, but it's a city gives name to...
A city with it, yeah.
Exactly. A larger region. And then...
Where's it at?
What?
Where's it at now?
Looking at the moment. It's north of Damascus. There's a modern actually city named Helbon that's in that area, slightly northeast of Damascus. This place is also mentioned beyond the Assyrian Chronicles. It's also mentioned in classical sources as a great place for wine. Again, looking back to Strabo. For example, talks about this area and the wine of Helbon. So this is not ordinary type wine. This is your very expensive bottles that of you know, aged French wine type thing that are luxury goods. These are not just whatever you're getting at the store and putting out on the table. And then white wool. Again, that's an interpretation of how you're going to read the wool is clear, it's semet, and then there's this sahag, which is a hop oxygen occurring here, based on an Arabic cognate. It's sort of this idea of the yellowish or tawny type color, but the idea is this clean wool, and the idea is probably that you're getting wool from these sheep shearing areas because you have all the purple dye and you need to be making these textiles to dye it. So you're getting these high quality wools to make your textiles, and that these may be coming from Damascus. It's kind of translated as white wool. All right.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you had, had some kind of emendation or suggestion. What verse were you thinking about at that point?
The next one.
Okay, good. Because I'm worried we're going to run out of time before we hear it.
Oh no! We'll get to the next one, and this is the one that has the big emendation that you can all go for. So someone read this verse for us, and let's see what you guys have. Verse 19.
And casks of wine from Izal were exchanged for your products. Wrought iron, cassia, and sweet cane were among your merchandise.
Okay, who has something completely different from that? Yeah.
Dan and Jason paid for your wares, traversing back and forth, wrought iron, cassia, and cane among your merchandise.
Okay, so the first version you heard read is taking into account the emendation. The first one is closer to the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text is, let me show.
Vedan,
Vaya,
Me'uzal,
Yavan, Me'uzal?
Me'uzal.
So they read that Vedan as and Dan, the biblical tribe of Dan. The Yavan, they're reading it again as a repeat of this from Greece. And Uzal, or paid for your wares. The Vedan Me'uzal, Be'izbon, like again, for your exports. So the emendation is coming in these first three words, in this idea that Dan, why is that included with Israel if that's going to be here? And then reading Yavan again, and then this idea of Me'uzal, which it's not entirely clear. So the pithel.
None of the other verses have started with a bit for the country. It's always you.
Right. The emendation comes from Alan Millard, and he basically says that this doesn't really make any sense. And at the end of the previous verse, we don't have this idea of sold for your wares that we have coming up in the middle of this verse. So he thinks this is a continuation of the list of goods coming from Damascus. And so what Millard does is he ends up with, first of all, he thinks Me'uzal can stay the same, and he's identifying Uzal as Izala. Izala is another Aramean province, and like Helbon, another one associated with wine production. It's well attested in the Assyrian text, and Uzal, reading as Izala, is an acceptable emendation.
So you're saying in other texts, Izala is known for wine?
Yeah, yeah. In the Assyrian text, it's known Izala, like Helbon, listed with Helbon as this fine and famous wine. Okay. So then for Yavan, he's reading it as Yain, right? So Yain of Izala to match Yain of Helbon. So that's a Bob Yod switch. That's a fairly standard emendation. That's not too difficult. So then what to do with this Vedan? So the ve you can keep because it's and, because we're continuing from the last verse. And then he's going to go a little bit of switch here. And,
there's no yud. Just bab dalet
nun. Ah, bab dalet nun. Great. Yeah, right. So he goes dalet nun and then a little
yud. Right?
Yes.
Because the yud would be like the bab.
Exactly. And then this he's linking to a word that you have for casks or pitfoy. And there's a, it's coming from, again, this kind of danune, which would be a type of large storage jar. So large jars of wine from Izala. And so that's where that's coming from. There's, again, there's a few letters switching around, and then this is continuing the list of goods from Damascus.
So he's reading this as the yud here.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a...
Exactly. Right. So that's a fairly major emendation in terms of meaning, but a fairly minor one in terms of moving just a couple of letters around, and in my opinion makes a lot more sense because this Vedan and Yavan were difficult to identify, and again this wine of Uzala fits along with this wine of Helbon as another famous wine from this region. Also, the next thing would be wrought iron, would be a translation. There's iron ashof. Wrought iron comes from the idea that it's warped iron, iron ashof, but it's iron, it's butzer ashof, which is thick iron. So it's probably iron ingots. You get these large ingots of iron.
Can I ask you, am I right in thinking that they have a translation, they can't figure it out, so they rearrange the letters to make it make sense?
Yeah. No, not rearranged letters. It's more there are certain letters that look very, very similar in ancient script.
Yes.
And so by assuming one of those got misread, the text now makes a whole lot of sense. It's just assuming that there was a misreading or a miscopy for things that look very, very similar.
Vedan and Rodan, isn't it in the Septuagint, Rodan?
Believe it is. I have to go back. I don't have the Septuagint up right now.
So the question is, if you have an ancient translation done in, you know, much, much closer to the time, and they did that, were they working off of a manuscript that made more sense than the manuscript that eventually we used?
Yeah.
So it's a question.
I mean, you're basically dealing with people that don't always write nicely. If you're trying to read half the stuff that I'm writing up here, someone could go in and when it's just a few.
And think, hopefully they're taking a lot of time to do this. They're not just we're going to figure this out.
But also knowing just even from ancient texts we've found, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, people that took a lot of time.
Hi.
Time's up.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. We're finishing. No, we were just going to go talk about trade goods for another, however long this lasted. So we're all fine. So we're done. We can go through the rest of them at some point. I also have a handout that discusses all of them, so if you're interested, you can come get a handout.
Let's go.